Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder joining us, you know, as a founder that has done it multiple times. We're going to be talking about what is it to build a company without really being a technical co-founder, especially when, you know, he's been doing deep tech, you know, type of stuff. He has two exits under his belt. He is now on this next thing, his next baby, you know, which is a rocket ship. We're going to be talking about it in just a little bit. And again, all the good stuff like the building, the scaling, the financing, and the exiting. So the full cycle, which we like to hear. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Dan Mackey. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So Dan, originally born in San Diego. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. I mean, I grew up in what I'll call kind of one of the older San Diego or Southern California surf towns. Now all these, you know, these communities are $3, $4, $5 million houses. But back when I grew up there, I mean, there were still horses on our street, right? And avocado farms. So it was really cool. You know, I have very pro-education parents. So we spent a lot of time outside at the beach playing sports, but also like, you know, taking like studies pretty seriously. And I ended up reading a lot as a child. And I think that's helped me throughout my whole life. Pretty, you know, quintessential Southern California experience, I'd say. And, you know, have like a lot of those cherished memories. And it's probably what brought me back to San Diego later on in life. And I'm sure we'll get to that a little bit later.
You did travel quite a bit, though, you know, before you actually did so. And, you know, we're talking about Asia, London. What really got you to decide to get out of, you know, the whole California area?
Yeah, I'm a big believer that like you could kind of treat life a little bit like a game. Okay. And for me in particular, like I really wanted to have a bunch of different experiences to figure out what I liked and what I was good at. And I think one of my skills is I'm incredibly comfortable being uncomfortable. Right. So I've, you know, lived in some not awesome housing in different parts of the world, but it didn't really matter because I was there to have experiences and work on myself and learn new things or try different jobs, right? I mean, I was an English teacher in South Korea. I was a snorkel and scuba guide in Thailand, and then lived and started my first company in London after grad school.
So how do you go from scuba diving to all of a sudden, you know, they're in Thailand, all of a sudden you're in London? I mean, that's quite the shift of gears.
Yeah, I think the story for how we got there is even better. You know, a bunch of us became really good friends being English teachers in South Korea, and we decided we were going to travel around Southeast Asia for a number of months before everyone went back to the real world, right? And I was walking out of a bar at like 10 o'clock at night, and there was a sign on a scuba shop that said English speaking tour guide needed. And I told the guys as they were closing up, I was going to come take that job. And they probably just saw some drunk guy and they're like, all right, get out of here, right? And I showed up the next morning in the, you know, the bootleg Lacoste polo t-shirt that I bought at the market on the way over there. And I actually decided to kind of wait a year to go to grad school to go do that. And that was awesome. I mean, it's a very physically demanding job. So you'd work kind of 2 4-hour shifts doing tours, right? Or one big long shift in the day. And then you'd come and have to clean up the shop, fill up the tanks, and then sell all the next trips for the next day. So we're talking really long hours, but it was probably one of the best times of my whole life. We lived on this island called Koh Phi Phi in Thailand. It's really famous from the Leonardo DiCaprio movie, The Beach. And it was actually when I was working there that I met the guy named Will Dickinson, who was an English guy on his gap year, who I ended up starting FanPix with. So it was incredibly fortuitous. And again, it's just an example of if you go out there and you take the risk and you're open to new ideas and new people, you're going to meet some really interesting folks and your life will take a lot of very unique directions.
So once you got out of Thailand, you go to London, you do your, you do grad school, you went there to the London School of Economics, one of the top schools, by the way, for business. And in this case, you know, you decided to pack the bags, go back home and start a company, Fanpix, as you were alluding to, no? Why running back to California versus staying in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, you're going to open a whole can of worms with this one. Let's just say this, the fundraising environment in the UK, and this is probably 2010, 2011, it was atrocious. I think the best offer we had was a maybe for like £250,000 for 35% of our company. We ended up moving to New York for a number of months before ending up in San Diego. And we ended up raising like $4.5 million at a $25 million valuation for our idea. And I think it just really spoke to the story that you, when you talk to a lot of entrepreneurs who go the VC backed way, a lot of folks in America, like it's a very optimistic society. It's a can-do society for better or worse. But a lot of folks really have somebody they know, you know, either in their family or a friend, especially if you're in California, who got rich doing tech, right? So I think there's that one, there's the cowboy mentality where you attract people from all over the world who want to kind of do something different and potentially make a lot of money. And then two, it's just culturally like embedded in that, outside of the immigrant side of things is like, you know, you can make a fortune here. And I don't think at times you have that same opportunity in Europe. A lot of my friends that stayed there, they work at banks, right? They're consultants. A number of them work in government. These are all really, really smart people. But I think the entrepreneur, you know, ecosystem is substantially better there now than it was 15 years ago. But the US has just been supercharged with 30, 40 years of like massive exits. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Now let's talk about Fanpix. So you ended up going to California, you ended up raising the money, but before that, I mean, what were you guys doing at Fanpix? How did the whole idea and the concept for the company come together?
Yeah, the gist is really simple. It's all based around sports and spending time with your family, right? So I don't know if you're a sports fan, but I'm sure you can think of a big game you've gone to or a big game you've watched on TV. And when your team scores a goal, hits a home run, wins the game, whatever, like everyone hugs each other, everyone jumps around. The whole idea was, you know, when you go on Splash Mountain at Disneyland, right? You get that reaction picture of yourself like this. We basically built a robotic camera system you'd put in sports stadiums that was so fast you could take pictures of everyone in the stadium in real time. So you could deliver those reaction pictures of you and your loved ones to your phone. So it was a really cool idea. It was a little ahead of its time. And what I'll say is that I think the biggest lesson we learned from that is sports is a tough business because you have so much money coming from TV that a lot of times the fan experience suffers. And teams are trying to get better at that now, right? But just think about this, like a lot of these sports franchises, no matter how good or bad you are, every year you get a check for a couple $100 million. It is the most amazing business of all time. So your incentive structure is always not aligned to have like the best in the stadium fan experience.
No kidding. Now, in this case, you know, what ended up being the business model? How were you guys monetizing?
Yeah, it was, we'd put the cameras in and then we'd basically do a revenue share with the teams on selling sponsorship on the pictures.
That's pretty cool. Now, you guys did this for about 3 years or so. And I believe that the total amount raised there was about 8 million. How was the journey too of going through the capital raising, being the first rodeo for you guys? I mean, how, obviously now, you know, you've raised a bunch of money with your next company, which we'll talk about it, but the first time around, how was it?
It's tough. You don't know what you don't know. And so I think, again, if you can be comfortable being uncomfortable and you can understand that when investors tell you no, right? They're not, it's not about you. It's about usually the business 95% of the time, right? So you learn not to take things personally and you learn the resilience that's required to basically, when you get knocked down, get right back up and go do it again, right? And so again, if you can kind of separate those things in your brain, right? Because no one likes rejection, and understand that they're doing their job on the other side of the table, it gets more comfortable the longer you go.
Now, in your guys' case, first, say, in Rodeo First Exit, the company ended up getting acquired. So how was it like going through that thing, that first time around too, through an acquisition and seeing the full cycle?
Yeah, we were acquired during COVID, right? And it was a really hard time for anything that was like live sports oriented, as you can imagine, right? And so, you know, the company, in a sense, like, I think, again, it was a couple years too early. If I was going to say, I think this thing would do really, really well right now. But again, you don't have the same incentive structure for the rest of kind of the world that you have if you're the team owner, because you just get the check no matter how good or bad the team is. You know, we didn't really make any money on the deal, but you know, it is a process, and when you go through it, you learn along the way. But it really helps set us up for success later down the road.
So in this case, you know, as you said, later down the road, you know, the next chapter was Citadel. So how did Citadel come knocking, you know, the idea, and how did you decide it, you know, it was time to go for it?
Yeah, I think what I've learned in life is that if you are attuned to what is around you, you'll really have opportunities to do interesting things. And so in 2015, I started getting asked at a bunch of sports stadiums while I was still at FanPix, could you build us a drone defense system? We had a problem with drones coming into sports stadiums. So in 2015, started Citadel. 2016, early 2017, the Naval Special Warfare, so the Navy SEAL community, came and found us and then took our stuff to Iraq to fight ISIS. We were actually building the system for airports and for sports stadiums, which is the world I understood, right? Because that was that, like, the pictures from FanPix were great. Okay, they were vitamins. But defending against a terrorist attack is like a vaccine, and people will pay a lot more for a vaccine. And so it was kind of by chance that we became a defense contractor. Okay. They found us because they had a really big problem. A lot of the big prime, you know, your Lockheeds, your SRCs of the world, their solutions were not working in Iraq, and ISIS was using these drones. So they got desperate and started looking for other solutions.
I wanted to ask you there on this one, because I think it's interesting what you're just saying. How is it like when you're selling to, you know, to government, you know, on to the Department of Defense? I mean, what is that like?
It's really tough. Okay. It is also a game. The best technology doesn't always win. You have to understand a couple different things, right? You have to understand what are the requirements that are out there. And there's not always a requirement out there. And so if there isn't a requirement, how do you build a requirement? The second is you have to understand how is it employed into kind of, let's just say, the guidelines that exist for how you employ different technologies into the battlefield. And then finally, you have to sometimes find the money for that. And so a lot of people right now, especially, are really excited by defense tech. They think it's having a moment, right? But we didn't know any of this at our first go around, right? And so we learned by getting punched in the face every single day and hiring people who understood how to do it. But once you kind of understand the process, and the process is long and complicated and takes a lot of money, you know, you can basically, all you have to do is get a slice of these defense budgets and you can build massive companies, right? Because defense is a big business.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
In this case, you guys raised about $13 million. Was it a little bit easier on the second time around where people, you know, since you were an exited founder, you know, now giving you a little bit easier the money?
Yeah. So FanPix hadn't been transacted yet. So I was kind of learning those lessons again at that point, but it right. didn't really matter because, again, it was that resilience we learned on the first time that you're going to hear no a lot along the way. And again, we had some really good gold star customers in the United States Naval Special Warfare community who were saying, like, this is going to be a big company. This is a good technology, and really got kind of the right folks to buy into it. In fact, one of the investors in Citadel is also my investor at Firestorm, but we'll tell that story later. And so, you know, it is easier every time you do anything in life. You know what I mean? And so I definitely think that was defense wave one. We're clearly in defense wave two now. I mean, some of these valuations are crazy, and we'll talk about that later. But yeah, it was really like, you understand the pattern recognition that you have something special, and you understand the customer demands. And then it's about executing on the product side of things so that you can get it where it needs to be to then unlock some of the bigger contracts.
Now, in this case, for you all, especially for you, I mean, you're not a technical co-founder. So how has it been to, you know, whether it was with FanPix or with Citadel or now with Firestorm? How has it been, you know, to be on the non-technical side?
It is a blessing and a curse, okay? It's a blessing because I can become the ultimate power user, right? If I can figure out how to use the technology, I'll represent your average user. And that's something that we try and do with every company we've started, which is simplify, right? And make the experience incredible when it comes to using a product. I want all of the complicated stuff to happen, you know, behind the scenes, but I just want the customer to be surprised and delighted and have it be really easy to use, right? And a lot of times the customer will help take you down that kind of path. So we have a test at Firestorm that we call the Dan test, which means I need to be able to set up and use a drone by myself, right? And I think that that's a really important lesson a lot of people who are doing design and who are building products should be thinking about. Now, how it's a curse is I have to basically go into these meetings and at times ask a variety of questions to make sure I'm getting to the center of truth, right? Because I can't actually build, you know, I can't write the code to do it. But again, that is a muscle memory, just like raising money. The more you do it, the more you understand people, the more you can have your bullshit meter go off, right? And there's just kind of some basic principles around like asking and pushing engineers to do stuff. You know, I spent a lot of time in my 20s reading books on like best practices for that. Am I the best? No, but I like to say I can like set the vision, raise the money, and then hire the people who are much better at that than me.
No kidding. Now for Citadel. You know, again, another exit. In this case, it was 9 figures. So walk us through how, you know, that happened, you know, timing, also what you've learned about timing when it comes to getting your company acquired, all of that good stuff.
Yeah, the timing on this one was interesting. So like, I think the company in general was like at this inflection point. Do we go raise more money or what do we do? And the acquirer was a company called Blue Halo, and they were basically buying a number of different future defense tech companies that they could put into one portfolio, right? And then offer, you know, hey, we have all this future defense tech. We can offer this to the government. We can help you kind of stay with the pacing threat, which was and continues to kind of be China. But what was interesting about this is we closed the transaction a couple months before we won a massive multi-hundred-million-dollar contract. So all the founders, all the team, everybody had a really good exit, right? And the investors. But if you know, the gods had moved things around a little bit differently, it might have been an even bigger outcome. The thing I'm the most proud of, though, is to this day, a couple times a month, we will talk to people who are like, that product, which was an anti-drone system, right, saved my life here or there. Like, I had one a week ago, and it is still incredible because so much of what we do in our lives is in front of a computer screen. You know what I mean? And when you have people who are doing dangerous things in dangerous areas tell you, wow, that made a big difference, it's really, really special, you know? And the most memorable one of those for me is the night of my like wedding, we had this big party after the reception. And one of my buddies who was in the Navy was at my wedding. And he just by chance at the club we had the after party at, ran into another one of his Navy buddies who had just been in a dangerous zone, okay? And our system had saved his life 2 weeks before. And he came up and was like, just profusely, like, I don't know, he was so excited. He basically bought me a huge bottle of tequila, being like, I don't think I would be here right now if the system that, you know, you had thought up all those years ago was not protecting us, because we had a bunch of drones come at us and the system stopped them from getting to our position. And so, you know, it's really cool, like, when you go through that part of the process, and still years afterwards, you know, the Citadel product, which lives on under the name Titan, is still having a profound impact on people. It's a really magical feeling. And I don't know. I can't quite describe it unless you've experienced it. You know what I mean?
I hear you on that. So let's talk about now Firestorm Labs. You know, an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. In this case, Firestorm Labs, third time around. So I'm sure that you really thought through, you know, why it made sense to really tackle this one.
Yeah, I mean, the idea came to us kind of in the buildup to the war in Ukraine. I always thought that, you know, we should have a begrudging respect for how ISIS used the DJI drones that you can buy at Best Buy to fight, you know, all of the best special forces in the world to a standstill for a number of months in northern Iraq and Syria. And so the whole idea is, why are you buying one drone for one mission? You should buy one drone that can do multiple missions. And this time around, I knew exactly what we needed to have from like a founding team standpoint. So Ian, my CTO, is an aerospace engineer, and he's got a background in additive manufacturing, aka 3D printing. And then Chad McCoy, he was at JSOC, which is a super elite, special operations group. And he's been on a bunch of important raids and used a lot of interesting technologies. He's famous for being on the team that saved Captain Phillips, right? So I needed the engineer, right? And I needed the guy who had a ton of credibility, who was eager to learn. And my job was to make sure that, like, we were getting the right kind of customer feedback on the product side, and then raise the money to build the team to go execute on it. And so we self-funded it for a year. And then we started to bring in a lot of defense investors. And I'll tell you, even the ecosystem for defense investors at the end of 22 and early 23, it's nowhere near the feeding frenzy that's happening today, because defense tech is now a massive category. But even 2 years ago, it was like a so-so category, you know?
So how do you guys make money, you know, with Firestorm?
Yeah, so we do a couple different things. So we build a variety of multi-mission drones. We can build them in about a tenth the time at about a fifth the cost. And then what we've actually done is we've invested millions of dollars to figure out how to put industrial 3D 3D printing systems into 20-foot containers. So now you can go have a factory anywhere in the world, right? A factory is no longer a fixed, like, you know, warehouse with the roof and power. We've modularized the whole thing. And it, now we're not just making our drones. We're fixing other people's drones. We're printing other people's drones. We're printing parts to military vehicles. We're working on medical braces. It's incredible what has happened here when you actually give the end customer a technology like this that they haven't had before. They will start giving you a flood of things to help them solve problems. And it's quite incredible.
So you guys have raised quite a bit here. How much have you guys raised and why did you choose the investors that you chose? And also tell us about that fun story with a repeated investor.
Yeah. So we've raised right around $50 million. We basically have gone and systematically taken a lot of the lessons learned from Citadel. So we have companies like Lockheed Martin on our cap table, and it's important to have the big guys on your team in defense. Because as much as people want to fix the defense acquisition process, until it's fixed, you have to play by the old rules. And so it's really good having somebody like them on their cap table. We've probably done over $1 billion of contract like bids with them. We have not won $1 billion of contracts. Let's make that clear. They're bringing us into a lot of really interesting programs that they cannot solve. And that they're relying on smaller companies that are more flexible to solve. We raised a lot of money because this is a big, big, like potentially generational business here, right? The way we build drones today, we build them like Ferraris. We don't need to build them like Ferraris. The Ukrainians and Russians have showed us you need to build them like minivans. You need to build a lot of them. You need to build them cheap and you need to be able to put different things on them, right? So it started with that. Break the mold for what we are actually building. And now we think the second and potentially even larger opportunity is bring industrial 3D printing to the market. And so a lot of this, when you sell to the DoD, is you have to show them things. So we end up doing a lot of road shows with really expensive systems so we can show people like what the art of the possible is. It's very different from like the consumer tech world where I just if Apple says they're going to build something, I'll kind of just believe they'll eventually do it, right? In the DoD, they've been burned so many times that they're skeptical until they believe you, if that makes sense. And that's the other lesson we learned, right? Is you got to prove the skeptics wrong.
So let's talk about the future here. So let's say you were to go to sleep tonight, Dan, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Firestorm is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Yeah, I think we have the ability to kind of revolutionize warfare. And how do you do that? Is you actually develop technologies that stop aggressive nations from attacking other ones. That's our big thing. We think deterrence is really important. We think we're spending too much money on deterrence right now. And that the way in which we've built drones and how we think about them needs to fundamentally change across the West. We need to look at them as like we'll lose 95% of them. So again, let's not build them like Ferraris. Let's build them like minivans, and let's put the infrastructure in place around the world to not only support the manufacturing and repair of these systems, but to really bring down the cost across the military in general for fixing and repairing and deploying things that we can do with our printing systems.
So let's talk about now the past with a lens of reflection. Mm. Let's say I put you into a time machine. And I bring you back in time, you know, maybe to that point where you were coming out of the London School of Economics and you have the opportunity of having a chat with your younger self before actually going at it with Fanpix, right around the time where you were thinking about becoming an entrepreneur and taking the plunge. What would be that piece of advice that you would give to your younger self before starting a business and why, given what you know now?
I would have taken the job at BlackRock. No, I'm just totally kidding. it's a great thing, and it's a question I think about constantly, right? My advice to my younger person is it takes just as much time to do something very big as it does to do something very small. It really does. So dream big, and don't be afraid to fail, and jump in there and go for it.
I love it. I love it. So Dan, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, LinkedIn. I'd say is the best way for me. Dan Magee. And I've got a black and white picture as my my user picture. I think there's a second Dan Magee. He's a cousin in Michigan. So we're the San Diego Dan Magee here. But reach in, say hi, add me, and let's chat.
Wonderful. Well, Dan, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.